If it's Monday, debt talks and border fallout. The president prepares to meet with top congressional leaders ahead of a crucial June deadline to avoid a government default, as the administration breathes a small sigh of relief at the southern border, days after the end of pandemic-era restrictions. Plus, breaking news, John Durham, the special counsel who's been investigating the origins of the Trump-Russia probe for more than 2 years now, has just released the findings of his long-anticipated report. We'll have the biggest takeaways and the latest reaction and fallout ahead. And two congressional staffers have been hospitalized after being attacked this morning by an assailant armed with a baseball bat at the district office of Virginia Democratic Congressman Jerry Connelly. Welcome to Meet the Press Now. I'm Garrett Hake, in for Kristen Welker. Moments ago, Special Counsel John Durham released his long-anticipated Durham Report, officially closing the books on a two-plus-year investigation into the FBI and Robert Mueller's probe into Trump and Russian interference in the 2016 election. In the 300-plus-page report, Durham faults the FBI for even opening the probe in the first place. Our team's going through that report as we speak, and we'll have more in just a minute. But we begin today with one eye on Washington and the other on the southern border, as the White House contends with two of its most pressing and enduring political issues, the border crisis and the economy, more specifically, the debt ceiling. Things at the border appear to be improving in the wake of policy changes late last week, as the pandemic-era asylum policy known as Title 42 that once allowed border agents to turn away nearly all asylum seekers expired on Thursday night. Department of Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas said yesterday that border apprehensions have actually declined 50% in the days since. It's a hopeful sign for overwhelmed shelters in the area and overwhelmed government officials.
Over the past 2 days, the United States Border Patrol has experienced a 50% drop in the number of encounters versus what we were experiencing earlier in the week before Title 42 ended at midnight on Thursday. It is still early. We are in day three. But, you know, we've been planning for this transition for months and months, and we've been executing on our plan, and we will continue to do so.
So it's too early to say whether the surge has peaked.
It is too early.
As you can see, border apprehensions have gone from record highs, over 11,000 in a single day on Tuesday, to less than half of that, around 4,400 just 3 days later. NBC has also learned that the number of migrants remaining in CBP shelters has dropped as well. Multiple migrants told NBC News there was a whisper campaign in the migrant camps in Mexico, encouraging migrants to cross before the pandemic policy was removed and then replaced with potentially stricter measures. Now, the Biden administration's new policy requires migrants to formally make an appointment with border officials or first seek asylum in another country. Crossing illegally could mean a 5-year ban on reentry and potential criminal prosecution. Yesterday, President Biden told reporters he hopes the numbers at the border will continue to go down and that the administration has a lot more work ahead of them. The president's comments came as he prepares to meet with congressional leaders tomorrow for their second round of talks over avoiding a potentially disastrous government default. The president told reporters in Philadelphia this morning that there are no updates on negotiations. And House Speaker Kevin McCarthy told reporters today the two sides remain far apart.
I appreciate the president finally willing to talk after 97 days, but there is no movement. And when you look where we're going, if this is where we were in February we're talking, we'd be in a good place. But we're only a couple weeks away. And if you look at the timeline to pass something in the House and pass something in the Senate, you've got to have something done by this weekend. And we are nowhere near any of that.
And what do you need to feel better about?
I got to see some real movement on the issue.
According to the Treasury Department, the U.S. could default as early as June 1st. But an unofficial deadline for negotiations looms much closer as Biden is scheduled to leave the country for the G7 summit on Wednesday. Joining me now is Monica Alba at the White House. And Julia Ainslie has been all over the situation at the border. She's back in Washington and joins me on set. But Monica, I'll start with you. Over the weekend, the president stuck a pretty optimistic tone on the debt. But this morning and then again this afternoon, we heard from Kevin McCarthy being much less optimistic. How is the White House squaring the very different attitudes the two key players are taking today?
Yeah, Garrett, you and I spend our days talking to and covering the same characters, but we're often watching two completely different movies and plot lines here, right? This is something where the White House feels continually optimistic. They say just because talks have continued to progress, the fact that at the staff level, those meetings started last week, continued all the way through the weekend, and since they haven't fallen apart, essentially, that is why the president says he still believes there can be some kind of an agreement reached here, while Republicans and House Speaker Kevin McCarthy have really pointed out what may be the reality here, which is that both sides continue to be completely miles apart. Now, something we did seem to see a little bit of movement on over the weekend was this area of common ground starting to soften a little bit, maybe some potential areas of compromise emerging. But the bigger question here is which side is going to blink first and say, okay, I can give up a little bit on what I had wanted to get out of this process, or are you going to do that first? So the president continues to believe that he is going to be meeting with the top congressional leaders tomorrow in the Oval Office to kind of take a summary view of what the staff talked about all weekend and going into today to evaluate really and kind of give a reality check on whether anything can be hammered out in a kind of framework before he leaves for that major trip to Japan and Australia on Wednesday. But as you know, that's 24 hours to try to solidify some things that are still pretty murky right now.
Well, and as the speaker put it today, the progress would be progress if we were having this conversation in February, but he was not feeling good about having it in mid-May. Mon, on the Title 42 part of this, I feel like we all spent all last week kind of preparing for the worst. Certainly the White House seemed to be preparing for the worst. Are they seeing what we're seeing in terms of the border numbers as kind of a happy surprise, or are they saying this is what they expected all along?
The Biden administration is saying essentially that the plans that they put in place, this is proof that they are so far working the way that they're supposed to. Remember that we had almost like a trial run for Title 42 lifting back many months ago before the court stepped in and delayed it until now to be tied with the public health emergency. So the Biden administration, DHS, the White House had had a lot of planning meetings, a ton of discussions, and had laid out this six-pillar plan for surging resources to the border, all this additional personnel that you saw there, getting some of these facilities to process people, they say, and they hope in a more efficient manner. But they really hadn't been able to see how this was all going to work in practice until just the last couple of days. And in terms of conversations that I've had, they say, look, it may be too soon to say that everything is really going in the direction that they're hoping for, which would be this kind of a drop off. Even though the early days and early numbers are suggesting that, they're still bracing for something that could be a different story in the coming days as this continues, and we really just haven't been here before in so long that nobody wants to take any kind of a victory lap or anything like that. But they are pointing to the fact that they feel that the message did get through to some migrants, that coming, making that incredibly arduous journey, going through the treacherous conditions only to be met at the border and potentially not be able to get across and seeking asylum, that that message did resonate with some who are attempting to make that journey. Garrett.
All right, Monica Alba at the White House. Monica, thank you. And Julia, welcome back. You were in Texas basically all last week. These numbers on paper look great, about 50% down in terms of apprehensions at the border. Is that surprising to you based on what you saw down there?
Yeah, a little bit. I think so. I think it was surprising because, you know, I've been looking at these planning documents and the things that they've been planning for even since last April when they first planned on lifting it. And they were mapping out projections for 18,000 border crossings a day.
Wow.
Yesterday, about 4,100 crossed the border. We're in a totally different universe. And I think that this is all, it's two things, right? Sometimes migrants want to see what happens. They give it a cooling off period. There's a change in policy. Let's see who goes through first, how they do, see how they report back. It also, though, has something to do with a lot of what's going on far south of our border. And that is stepped up law enforcement from Mexico, Guatemala, Panama, and Colombia, all interdicting migrants and smuggling networks along the way. Now, that is because of the U.S. They laid a lot of groundwork with those countries to beef up that enforcement because they were expecting this surge. But so far, that might be what's contributing to even keeping migrants from reaching our border in the first place.
It does beg the question, if those steps were so effective, why not do them much, much earlier in this process?
In some parts, they are hampered by money. I mean, they are still $3 billion short of what they need to be able to carry something like this out in the long term. In fact, that's why they had these contingency plans to try to release some migrants without court dates or the ability to track them, although they were blocked by a Florida court from doing that. But the idea is that this could be a short-term rush of resources you know, 1,000 more asylum officers. They have lawyers who can get on a phone with an asylum officer and a migrant as soon as they cross in. They pick up a phone in a border processing phone booth and they figure it out. Can they sustain that in the long term if Republicans won't fund any part of Biden's border agenda? We'll have to see.
What do you think of the secretary's comments that it is really too early to see here? I mean, how much of that is based on funding and how much of that is based on, I mean, I think these numbers demonstrate that we just don't know all the things we don't know, right? I mean, we can only control so many factors and the rest is pretty opaque.
It is. There are so many factors. We still have 20 million displaced people in the Western Hemisphere. No matter what we talk about in Washington, there's only so much we can control. I think they're really reluctant to take a victory lap. That it's still too early is something that was repeated to a lot of media reporters, DHS reporters on the phone today. But I think one of the things my sources are telling me is look at the numbers in Border Patrol custody. Even though these other numbers have fallen by 50%, we're only down to 21,000 in Border Patrol custody. That's still more than they have space for. And it takes longer to process under these new rules than it did under Title 42. So even if you have fewer coming across, if they're staying longer in custody, you have to release more of them. And the best laid plans don't take care of the fact that when you release migrants onto the street, they tell somebody else that they got through, more will come.
It's such a complicated issue. You've done a great job covering it. Welcome back to D.C.
Thank you. Got back for Mother's Day.
That's what we like to see. All right, good. All right, Julia, thank you. So I want to bring in the mayor of Laredo, Texas now, Victor Trevino. Mayor Trevino, now that Title 42 has expired, talk to me about what you're seeing there just across the Rio Grande. How are things in Laredo?
Well, first of all, thank you for having me. And of course, there's no doubt that we're seeing historic challenge we've never seen before at our southern borders. But before the end of Title 42, our local hospitals and NGOs were already near capacity or at capacity. But everything we've been doing here since the declaration of emergency locally has held up. And we have not been overwhelmed to this point. We're receiving about 300 to 400 migrants daily from around 700 before. And our emergency managements are holding up. But however, because we received the overflow from El Paso and Brownsville, Texas, we're still at high alert. And we see that the numbers in the Border Patrol custody have gone down. But this is something we just have to be vigilant on. We have a medical underserved situation here, which was on the pandemic. And we don't want this to be the new normal. So these are things that we're looking at as we speak.
Talk to me about the lead up over the last, you know, couple of weeks to this. Do you feel like you've gotten in place all the resources you need from the federal government and from the state of Texas?
That's the reason for the declaration of disaster, because we're able to activate these resources. We're able to activate whatever we need to do locally, shelters, the buses and the NGOs. This is a way to actually be on alert and have our stakeholders ready. But we can't continue this roller coaster ride any longer. I mean, this is an emergency declaration. We have to be cognizant that we're underserved and we only have a certain amount of resources here. This is what I think it's an American problem. It's not a local problem. We have to do local things for a federal problem. So this is where we're at right now.
Well, to that end, I mean, you are on the front line of this. If you're talking to the White House, if you're talking to the administration, what do you need from the rest of the country? What are you asking the White House for to help you address this problem where you live?
Yeah, I think what we need to do is get mayors of the borders involved with a conversation with the federal government. And so they can have our perspective and point of view. We live and work here. We know on the ground what happens here. There might be a disconnect on people that are not living here. So this is something I'd like to see. And migrants may be thinking differently right now because of all the situations that are going and all the new rules. So this is America, the beacon of freedom, the example for the rest of the world. So we have to balance humanitarian efforts with security, of course.
You talk about the idea that this is America's problem to solve. And one of the ways that your governor has been bringing it to the attention of the rest of the country has been this idea of busing migrants to Democratic-run cities, including migrants from Laredo. Do you think that's helpful in any way, or does it politicize the crisis? What's your view of the way the governor's been handling this?
Well, these are situations that they do a lot of things to put a Band-Aid on things. It helps a little bit. But we have to understand that the smugglers are the ones in control or passing the migrants. So that's a situation we have to be cognizant of. Any little bit helps, but I think this immigration reform should have been done a long time ago. And this is the evidence of what happens if no reform was done in many years before, many decades.
What do you make of the changes that the Biden administration's put in place just within the last week or so? I don't know if you heard what Julia was just talking about, but some of the ideas about changing, enforcement further south and changing the ways that the CBP moves people around. Are these changes that could have been helpful earlier? Do you think they can hold if the numbers pick up again sometime in the near future?
Yeah, well these things that they have done do help. But like I said, these are things acting reactively. We should have done this a long time ago proactively. But definitely that might be contributing to the decrease in the migrants we're seeing.
How do you handle the balancing act that you have to have between, you know, enforcing the law, protecting your city, and also trying to have a humanitarian response to the people who are showing up on Laredo's doorstep? It is both a legal challenge and a humanitarian crisis.
It is difficult. So prevention for me, I'm a medical doctor, is number one. I try to prevent things before they happen. So I always push that prevention issue because then we'll be acting after the fact, and that complicates matters. So I think all these prevention measures can be done before we see the situation get worse.
And last question, I think, what are you seeing, you know, across the river in Mexico? What are you watching for to try to determine whether this, you know, kind of cutback that we've seen over the last few days is going to hold, or whether you need to be bracing for big numbers again?
That's the reason we have to have good communication with our border partners. And that's crucial because we get inside information on what's going to happen or what the situation is over there. We just can't be expecting things to happen. If we have the information, the collaboration, that really helps a lot.
All right, Mayor Victor Trevino, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
And coming up, Special Counsel John Durham's years-long investigation into the origins of the FBI's Trump-Russia probe is now closed. Key takeaways from the Durham report, released for the first time just minutes ago, next. Plus, breaking news, two congressional staffers have been attacked with a baseball bat in the office of Democratic Congressman Jerry Connelly. The suspect is in police custody, and the two aides are in the hospital. More details ahead. You're watching Meet the Press Now.
Join Hoda Kotb for a brand new season of her podcast, Making Space.
For season 5, I am making space to talk to people who are providing a sense of hope and inspiration when life changes course.
Uplifting conversations with inspiring individuals like NFL legend Drew Brees, singer-songwriter Ziggy Marley, and Today Show co-anchor Savannah Guthrie as you have never heard her before.
I found faith more viscerally, not because the bad thing didn't happen, but because it did.
I promise you, like me, will leave these conversations with some wisdom for your own journey, empowered and inspired to make space in your own life.
New episodes of Making Space with Hoda Kotb are released every Wednesday. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.
If you ever needed to be persuaded that bad things can happen anywhere, then take a journey with us.
From compelling mysteries to in-depth investigations, our Dateline episodes are available as podcasts.
Follow Dateline NBC now to get new episodes every Tuesday. To listen ad-free, subscribe to Dateline Premium on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or datelinepremium.com.
Great storytelling with a twist from the true crime original.
And welcome back. As we mentioned, after more than 2.5 years since being named special counsel, John Durham has now released his final report. The 300-page report says the FBI acted too hastily when it opened its investigation into Russian interference in the election, and that it was based on, quote, raw, uncorroborated information. Remember, Durham was appointed special counsel by then Attorney General Bill Barr to investigate the FBI's probe into Russian interference in the 2016 election, as well as to look into Special Counsel Mueller's investigation of Trump. Now, over the course of this investigation, Durham indicted three individuals, securing one guilty plea, resulting in probation and two acquittals. Joining me now is Justice and Intelligence Correspondent Ken Delanian, who's been digging into this report. So, Ken, what's in this thing and what are we learning?
It's an exhaustive look at what the investigation codenamed Crossfire Hurricane. And there are a lot of different rabbit trails that this report goes down. But I think fundamentally what it does is it suggests that the FBI should not have opened this investigation in the first place. And that, as you said, it did so too hastily based on uncorroborated information, and that basically the FBI was suckered by a bunch of people with political agendas. Now, the problem with this thesis is that it runs directly contradictory to another independent report by the Justice Department's Inspector General back in 2019, which took an exhaustive look and found that, in fact, there was proper predication for this investigation, that the FBI acted appropriately in opening it, and also found no evidence, no demonstrable evidence of political bias in doing it. Now, obviously, one of the agents involved, a man named Peter Strzok, was found later through text to have expressed, you know, animus towards Donald Trump. He was not a Donald Trump fan, but he was not the only decision maker here. There were others. And look, there's a lot of different aspects to this report. I mean, one of the cases that Durham tries to make is that information about potential counterintelligence threats involving the Clinton campaign was treated differently. But what he doesn't address is the context was so different. Mm-hmm. Here you had Donald Trump, who was publicly asking the Russians to find 30,000 missing emails from Hillary Clinton's server, who was expressing admiration for Putin. That was the context that Durham really doesn't address in his report. Look, the other thing is there have been a lot of policy changes because there were some serious flaws in how the FBI approached, particularly its applications for foreign surveillance warrants, and the rules have been entirely overhauled in that respect. There's also a new rule that says the Attorney General has to approve any investigation into a political candidate or political campaign, and a lot of people would say that makes perfect sense given the stakes here. Ultimately, this investigation, as everyone knows, did not find formal coordination between the Trump campaign and Russia, but it found a series of troubling contacts, and a Senate Intelligence Committee report, bipartisan, went even further and said that those contacts posed a counterintelligence threat to the United States because the Trump campaign essentially opened their arms to help from the Russians.
Gary. Ken, I mean, obviously this is going to get a ton of attention, especially on the right. I'm looking at my Truth Social app now. Donald Trump has just posted. He says the American public was scammed. He's going to be driving a lot of attention towards this. How do you think the DOJ is going to react to this report and to that attention? Do you think they're going to try to come up with more reforms than the ones you were just talking about, even to just try to assure people, especially those who might be skeptical based on this, that they hear what they're saying, that they've taken this report seriously? Like, what happens now?
You're raising a very good point. The DOJ is very concerned about this reaction on the right. They don't want half the country to believe, as many millions of Americans do, that the FBI was out to get one particular side of the aisle, in this case, Donald Trump. And that's why Chris Wray, the FBI director, issued a statement essentially distancing himself from some of the decisions made in this investigation and saying, look, that was then, this is now. We've made a host of changes. Some of these mistakes would not happen again. And this Justice Department feels similarly. They want to divorce these institutions from politics, and they want the whole country to believe that it's on the level, but they're just dealing in a climate of misinformation. The thing, you know, Trump will proclaim that this report vindicates him, but it actually does opposite, because he says that this was all corrupt. John Durham went looking for corruption. He looked hard for corruption. He interviewed every CIA analyst who had their hands on this and every FBI official, and he found none. He couldn't establish, and he was 0-for-2 in court. What he found was essentially a difference of opinion about the strength of this case.
Ken, I imagine in the two-hour version of this show, we would probably talk more about the special counselization of the Justice Department that's grown out of this, where everything gets farmed out. But alas, we're only doing the one-hour show today, so we got to leave it there. Thank you for your reporting and your time digging into that report, Ken. And now we've got some more breaking news, this time out of Virginia, where, according to Democratic Congressman Jerry Connolly and law enforcement officials, an individual with a baseball bat entered his district office and attacked two members of his staff. That individual is now in police custody, and Connolly says his staffers have been transferred to the hospital with non-life-threatening injuries. Connolly has represented Virginia's 11th district, which includes Fairfax County, going all the way back to 2009. Joining me now is senior national political reporter Sahil Kapoor on the Hill. So, Sahil, what more do we know about this attack tonight?
Well, Garrett, we know this attack took place in Fairfax, Virginia, the suburbs of Washington, not far from where I am on Capitol Hill right now at 10:49 a.m. Capitol Police says two congressional staffers were assaulted with a metal bat, received non-life-threatening injuries. They mentioned that Congressman Connolly was not in the office at the time of the assault, even though Connolly, in a statement of his own, said an individual entered his office with a baseball bat asking for him before committing this act of violence. The congressman went on to say that his focus at this time is on ensuring that they are receiving the care they need. We know that the U.S. Capitol Police has launched a joint investigation into this assault with local police, and they have arrested a 49-year-old man from Fairfax. Capitol Police says it is not clear what the suspect's motivation may have been at this time, Garrett.
Sahil, I'm just thinking about all the related stories that we've covered, the attack on Paul Pelosi, the security changes made after January 6th. What are you hearing from lawmakers? What are you hearing from the Capitol Hill community about this? It is the concern of everyone who works on or adjacent to the Hill that this kind of violence is spreading.
That's absolutely right. There's been a major surge in threats targeting members of Congress, in some cases their family as well. The U.S. Capitol Police has tallied numbers on this. From 2017, it was a little under 4,000. It exploded to 9,625 credible threats in 2021. That's the year that, of course, began with the January 6th attack on the Capitol. It's a major concern to members of Congress, to the entire Capitol Hill community. We've seen lawmakers talk about how they are spending more and more amounts of money, larger amounts of money from their personal campaign funds on private security for themselves. Some have talked about buying body armor, adjusting their routines, taking all kinds of precautions to protect themselves physically that we would not have thought would have been necessary about a decade or 15 years ago, Garrett.
No. And Sahil, while I have you, I understand there's more news from the Treasury Department about that so-called X date here as relates to when we might hit the debt ceiling and how that might affect the negotiations going on the Hill. What can you tell us?
Well, Garrett, we know that the new X date is the same as the old X date. It is still June 1st. That is the date that Treasury Department says Congress must act by in order to prevent a breach in the debt ceiling. Now, there are always caveats on this. The Treasury Department can predict with a high level of confidence, but not perfect confidence, when money will run out, when there'll be no more money in the couch cushions to keep paying the bills and to risk default. So there are those caveats. But the key date is June 1st. That's in 2.5 weeks. Congress must act by then, Treasury says, in order to prevent a first ever default on U.S. debt, which it says would be economically catastrophic for this country, Garrett.
If you work on Capitol Hill and you're making Memorial Day weekend plans, buy refundable flights. Sahil Kapoor, thank you for your reporting on both those stories. And up next, countdown to election night. Kentucky Republicans head to the polls tomorrow to choose a candidate for governor in what may be the most important contest of the year. That's next. You're watching Meet the Press now. Welcome back. With plenty of focus on Donald Trump's frontrunner status in the 2024 presidential primary, tomorrow's GOP primary in Kentucky could give us an early glimpse at what influence he continues to have over the party and whether the power of Trump's word or Trumpism holds greater sway over Republican voters. Kentucky Attorney General Daniel Cameron and former Trump UN Ambassador Kelly Craft lead the field vying to take on incumbent Governor Andy Beshear in what's expected to be the most competitive race of 2023. Trump has endorsed Cameron, but Kraft has made up ground. Despite entering the race after Cameron, she's been hitting the AG over the airwaves with a bevy of attack ads. NBC's Dasha Burns has the latest.
In Kentucky's hotly watched governor's race, the former president looms large for both frontrunners.
Daniel Cameron, the only candidate endorsed by President Trump.
Cameron agrees with the George Soros-backed DA who prosecuted Trump. That's not conservative.
Though Kelly Craft hails from the Trump administration as his former ambassador to the United Nations.
President Trump sent me to the United Nations. And what a snake pit that is.
It's her opponent, Daniel Cameron, who has the endorsement of her former boss.
Your opponent in this race was endorsed by former President Trump. Why didn't he endorse you?
I was not in the race, so there was no choice.
Cameron playing up that endorsement.
A desperate Kelly Craft falsely attacks Daniel Cameron. But you know what's really strange? Craft worked for President Trump, and Trump endorsed Daniel, not Craft.
While downplaying his ties to Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell.
How has your association with Mitch McConnell influenced your political philosophy and your conservative convictions?
Well, do you recall when the folks were protesting on my front lawn?
Yes.
Did you see Mitch McConnell there?
No.
There you go. So I'm my own man.
You have been endorsed by former President Trump. You mentioned that in your ads, on your flyers. You also, though, have ties to Mitch McConnell, who's a longtime Republican, very powerful here in Kentucky and nationally. You don't mention that as much. Why not?
We're going to have to build a coalition that is large enough not only to win the May 16th primary, but also to beat Andy Beshear in November. And that is our ultimate mission.
The race becoming an early bellwether for Republican primary politics and a test for what message wins out with the base. Kraft leaning into Republican attacks on so-called woke culture.
We're not going to have activists. We're going to have responsible children, and we're going to support our teachers.
Making controversial statements about transgender students in Kentucky schools.
Can you clarify your comments on transgender folks in schools?
What I'm saying to you is I do not want these ideologies, these woke ideologies, the sexualization. I do not want that upon our children.
Criticizing Cameron for not pushing back on the Justice Department's investigation into the Louisville Police Department after Breonna Taylor's death, which found that the department, quote, unlawfully discriminates against black people in its enforcement activities. Meanwhile, Cameron leaning into his record as Kentucky's attorney general.
People recognize the work that I've done as attorney general, and I've been standing up for their constitutional rights and their values since day one in the attorney general's office.
While Kentucky went for Trump by 26 points in 2020, Governor Andy Beshear enjoys sky-high approval ratings, the Democrat winning over Republicans in his deep red state. The race, the latest test of President Trump's influence on the GOP in 2023 and beyond.
All right. Thank you to Dasha Burns for that reporting. And joining me now to discuss tomorrow's gubernatorial primary in Kentucky, as well as some other big political stories, is Amy Walter, publisher and editor-in-chief of the Cook Political Report. So, Amy, you heard Cameron talk or not talk about Mitch McConnell there, who really has been a mentor for him.
Absolutely.
Talk about the needle he has to thread there to avoid what appears to be a very unpopular Senate minority leader there.
That's the thing. You have one of the most powerful members of the United States Congress representing your state. That is normally something mm-hmm. that you want to yep. have an association with. But in this state, as in nationally, Mitch McConnell is associated with the anti-Trump wing or the Rhino wing or whatever the pejorative is mm-hmm. about sort of establishment Republicans. And so that's right. Daniel Cameron spending a lot more time talking about Trump than McConnell. But what it says about Cameron is that he's the kind of candidate that Mitch McConnell thinks can win in a state, even though it's a very dark red mm-hmm. state, but has the kind of background, message, experience to win. And so when you get a combination of somebody that Donald Trump likes and Mitch McConnell, that's a pretty good sign.
Oh, and McConnell doesn't mind that Cameron has
Absolutely
to run against
not.
Him, right? It's like whatever it takes
that's
to win,
right.
you just go ahead and do
that's
it.
That's right.
I mean, what do you make of that confluence of factors where you do have McConnell and Trump endorsing the same candidate? I mean, that was the case with Herschel Walker, but I think McConnell's people would tell you they had no other choice in Georgia.
I think that's right. And Cameron is also seen as something of an heir apparent to McConnell when he decides to leave the United States Senate. Mm. Some people were surprised that Cameron decided to run for governor instead of waiting for McConnell. But I think if, you know, there's an opportunity there, he's going to raise his name ID, whether he wins or loses, he becomes much better known. The other thing is Beshear, as you pointed out, he's representing a really red state.
Yeah.
You think, boy, this is going to be a tough race for Democrats. Now, look, it's harder to run when your party's in the White House and mm-hmm. you represent the opposite party. You're the opposite party in a state like
Kentucky, which was not
Kentucky,
the dynamic he had when
which
he
was
won
not
the first
the dynamic
time.
In 2019. At the same time, he is really popular. His approval ratings are over significantly over 50% in that state. So just trying to tie him to Biden, trying to tie him to the national environment will be tougher mm-hmm. than, say, when he was a candidate. Look at somebody like Laura Kelly in Kansas, who was able to succeed in a really red state, in part because people already liked her, even though they don't really like Joe Biden.
The idea of just run somebody who people like is like so shockingly foreign in politics right now. But it turns out it can be a very simple formula for success.
It's also nice to be a governor.
Well, that's true.
It's still hard to win in a state that your party is mm-hmm. not a majority, but it can be done. And once you've won, as long as you haven't really screwed up, as long as people still like you and think you're doing a good job, you can
You can stick around
a little
bit.
You can stick around a little bit.
Kentucky's one of those states that I sort of like pre-Trump. It always used to be a great barometer, right? The same way we look at the Virginia governor's race. What do you make of Kentucky as a potential barometer for the election we're going into in 2024? We're showing a graphic here of some of the times in which the way that Kentucky has gone has, you know, predicated what the White House has done the next year.
Look, I think I'm old enough to remember when there was a special election there back in the 90s that definitely predicated the wave that came and swept Democrats out of office. I think if Beshear loses, that is a pretty bad sign for Democrats because it suggests even popular politicians are going to have a hard time running when the pull of national politics, the pull of Biden's low approval ratings are just going to be too much for them. That didn't happen in 2022. Remember, all those Senate candidates who outperformed Joe Biden in their states or governors outperformed Joe Biden. It's harder because you're going to have lower turnout. That's the other thing to remember about this primary. They think they're going to have really, really low turnout in this primary. And so that adds a little interesting dynamic to this.
I want to squeak in one other southern state while I have you. North Carolina. We've got a Democratic governor who's going to veto this 12-week abortion ban. He might get overridden. I can't help but notice that we're talking about this on the same day that the Biden campaign is kind of getting out there the idea that they think they might want to try to compete in North Carolina next year. How salient do we think that shows that they feel the abortion issue still is?
They absolutely think that's a salient issue, and especially now that you have Republicans coming out and openly talking about having a national vote or having some sort of a national abortion plan. I think that makes it harder for whoever the presidential candidate is to be able to distance themselves from some of the things that the activists would like to see. But it's complicated. I will say that this issue was certainly powerful for Democrats in 2022. We've got a long way to go before 2024.
Yes, we do. And probably a lot of tap dancing on this question from Republican candidates between now and then. Yeah. Amy Walter, thanks, Garrett, for that analysis. And after the break, we're turning to the 2024 race for president as the feud between Florida's two potential frontrunners heats up. The panel is next. You're watching Meet the Press now. Welcome back. Turning to the 2024 presidential campaign, there is no need to adjust your television, but if you squint really hard, you can see in this clip Ron DeSantis taking what appears to be a shot at Donald Trump's campaign track record at an appearance in Iowa over the weekend.
There's no substitute for victory. We must reject the culture of losing that has infected our party in recent years. The time for excuses is over. If we get distracted, if we focus the election on the past or on other side issues, then I think the Democrats are going to beat us again. And I think it'll be very difficult to recover from that defeat.
Now, he said something similar in Florida this morning, and that's about as direct as it's going to get from Ron DeSantis, it seems. Donald Trump responded in an interview with The Messenger saying, quote, Ron's not a winner because Ron wouldn't, without me, he wouldn't have won. He's got no personality, and I don't think he's got a lot of political skill. Joining me now are some people with a lot of political skill. Benji Sarlin, the Washington bureau chief for Semaphore, Democratic strategist, and NBC News political analyst Juanita Tolliver, and Stephen Hayes, editor and CEO of The Dispatch. He's also an NBC News political analyst. So, Benji, I'll start with you. What do you think of that line of attack from DeSantis? It seems to me the biggest problem with it is you have to admit that Donald Trump lost to say that he was, in fact, a loser in 2020.
That's right. There's a difference between saying I, Ron DeSantis, am a winner and Donald Trump is a loser. And he has so far walked that fine line of not quite launching that attack. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he would get pressed more on this. But one thing that was notable from that Iowa trip is that he was expected to meet with the press and take questions and did not. That would have been the first question a lot of people would have asked. When you say there's a culture of losing and side issues and distractions, what are you talking about? So he will eventually have to flesh this out a bit more.
But Stephen, is this kind of the only needle you can thread if you're DeSantis? You don't want to attack Donald Trump's policy positions because you have many of the same ones. You don't want to attack his character because the rest of the party's rallied around him on that. So this is what you're left with?
Yeah, but I think it's a broader attack than the one that he's making. And as Benji says, it's not much of an attack. I mean, it's like not even a bank shot at this point. He's not naming him. We all know what he's talking about. But like, if you're going to make an attack, make an attack. No, I think there's a much broader effectiveness case. If you're a Republican and you hold most of the same positions that Donald Trump holds, you can say, look, Donald Trump said the wall was going to be built. The wall's not built. He said we're going to repeal Obamacare. Obamacare is still in place. You can go down a long list.
Voters still care about Obamacare?
I'm not sure that they do. But if you're Ron DeSantis and your path is peeling away some Trump voters, winning movement conservatives and being tolerable to the rest of the Republican Party, that's your path. And at some point, he's going to have to make a substantive critique. We saw what happens when people do sort of shrug your shoulders sideways attacks on Donald Trump, and that's why he was president.
I just want him to work up to actually saying Trump's name. That is the one thing that didn't happen here, because of course we all know Trump's a loser, 2018, 2020, 2022, right? The list goes on. But for him to distinguish himself, he's got to go beyond naming Mickey Mouse and name Trump directly as well.
Now, if you're at the White House this weekend, though, are you like, finally, there's a campaign on the Republican side, right? I mean, are Democrats salivating to see these two finally start going at it?
It's not even just seeing them going at it. It's about them spending money and resources over the next year and a half going at it, right? Because that means they're going to be in a weakened position coming into a general election when President Biden will have a war chest available to him. He won't have had to scrap with anybody up until the general election. So that's what it's about. Spend all your money hitting each other, please.
DeSantis has had money, but this was the first weekend where it looked to me like he had something like a campaign, right? Like he was actually on the ground in Iowa, making movements that looked like campaign movements here. He got some big endorsements. Is he a live player in Iowa yet, despite what we've seen in all these national
polls? Yeah, I mean, I think he is. We had a reporter out there, David Drucker from the Dispatch, on the ground with him and said, yeah, you know what? He passes the bar. He passes the eye test. He's better in sort of one-on-ones with voters than people might have expected. Now, that may be he's benefiting from low expectations because there's been reporting that he can't do it at all. Better than that, yeah, I think this is sort of the beginning of an actual campaign. He had said from the outset that he wanted to wait until after the legislative session was over. So now's sort of the time. But I think these next, you know, 6 weeks will be very important for him to establish himself as the alternative to Donald Trump, or if he's going to do it. Or you're going to start to see more Republican names appear beyond the people who we know are announced.
Well, and so, Benji, if you believe the coalition that Stephen was just talking about, movement conservatives and so forth, that's an Iowa recipe if there's going to be one here. How does Ron DeSantis do at least what Ted Cruz did in Iowa and then something better if he wants to be president? Didn't work for Ted Cruz.
Well, he's running a very similar play to Ted Cruz, which did win Ted Cruz Iowa. You know, that got him to the point of, you know, essentially a almost
being the other guy for a little while.
Which is, you know, it's a state with a very committed group of conservative activists who, especially in a caucus setting, can make a big difference. And you're already seeing him make up some ground with some of those kind of committed activists. You know, he rolled out a pretty impressive endorsement slate of 37 state legislators. I think that's about a third of the Republican caucus in the state. So he definitely is showing some of that Cruz life, that he can appeal to people who are very ideologically consistent conservatives. The question is, can you translate it into a nomination? Cruz could not.
We talked a little bit about this with Amy Walter in the last segment. The abortion issue continues to bedevil Republicans. They can't figure out how to talk about it. I want to play a little bit of what Nikki Haley had to say about it today. We'll ask you about it on the other side.
For a national standard, I think we have to tell the American people the truth. In order to do a national standard, you'd have to have a majority of the House, 60 Senate votes, and a president. We haven't had 60 pro-life senators in 100 years. So the idea that a Republican president could ban all abortions is not being honest with the American people any more than a Democrat president could ban these pro-life laws in the state. So let's be honest with the American people and say, let's find national consensus.
Now, I'm a Capitol Hill correspondent in my day job. What she says isn't wrong. The votes there would be extraordinarily hard to get. But Stephen, how does that play in a Republican primary?
Yeah, I mean, I think that was Nikki Haley could be sitting amongst us as making political analysis rather than actually stating a position as a candidate. I think one of her big challenges is she doesn't know where Donald Trump is on the issue. Right. So she can't echo the viewpoint that he has. She makes perfectly reasonable points. For Republican base voters who are likely to decide or at least shape the Republican primary competition, that's not what they want to hear. They would like her to be more outspoken.
Juanita, what do you make about this? I mean, we were talking about the North Carolina bill with Amy in the last segment. I mean, is this still like the kryptonite that Democrats can use against Republicans in different places that Republicans don't even know how to talk about this issue, much less legislate on it?
And when I saw that clip, what I saw was her saying, I'd still do it if I could. Right. Like, and that is the message that I think Democrats are going to roll out to voters, because remember, abortion is a mobilizing issue. It is an invigorating issue for Democratic voters. And they turned out in mass in what, Wisconsin earlier this year was yet another marker.
Reelected a governor in Kansas, of all places. I mean, Benji, does this make Donald Trump's answer actually politically the most palatable answer in a general election? They're like, I don't know. We'll see what happens. Try to make people happy. I mean, it's not a policy, but it's something that can thread the needle.
Well, it's all relative, right? Like, he could get a boost if he is attacked from the right this entire primary as being too squishy on abortion, and he comes out in general election and says, look, I was the one who got tagged as being too moderate. Mm-hmm. But at the end of the day, as he was just bragging in a clip that Democrats are already saving for a general election ads the other day, he was, you know, quote, proud and honored to have appointed the justices who overturned Roe v. Right. Wade. I mean, he hasn't changed his position on that. And that still is probably the core issue for voters. That's the language they understand.
Is that enough for Democrats to use against him? Here are your Supreme Court justices.
Celebrating the Supreme Court justices who overturned Roe, celebrating every ban across the country. Absolutely, that's ammunition. And that's going to come through in battleground states as well as the national mood.
Stephen, will we see Ron DeSantis run on the six-week ban that he signed in Florida, or is he going to try to run away from it?
So interesting. So we haven't seen him run on it. And it would be one place, I mean, as I mentioned earlier, that one of the things he's trying to do is peel away sort of the base of MAGA voters. And if you talk about a place that that might work, Northwest Ohio, with lots of religious conservatives, would be a place where you'd think he might emphasize that. He's not done it to this point. I suspect that that's because his team believes that that would either leave him in trouble in a general election, or because it's not an issue that Ron DeSantis is comfortable litigating sort of in those details.
I also remember that he signed that bill and posted about it at 11:30 at night on Twitter, right? It's not something he's out here celebrating. There was no big ceremony about this.
That's Mike Pence's music. This is the guy in the field who is comfortable talking about this kind of stuff, and we may see that. Benji, I think you're probably going to get the last bite of this. You are our policy guy. What do you make of the total disconnect between the way that President Biden and the way that Kevin McCarthy are talking about the debt ceiling negotiations that they are or are not having over the last week to try to avert a default?
Well, there's always a lot of theater around these negotiations. Of, you know, first of all, the theater for Democrats was, well, we won't negotiate on this at all, right? Well, suddenly there's a negotiation going on, right? Is it technically over the budget? Is it over the debt ceiling? No one will say, but they all agree there's talks and Biden's optimistic. Similarly, on McCarthy's end, even if he thinks he's close to a deal, he's going to have to sell this as, wow, we had the Biden administration over a barrel. You can't believe how they caved to us. If, you know, this early in the process, you're saying things are going great, it's harder to sell that.
Well, and it'll be permitting reform and spending caps or something like that. All right, well, we'll see where this all ends up. Guys, we could do 5 segments on this, but they don't let me do that. So anyway, I appreciate you all coming in. Juanita, Stephen, Benji, Sarlin, thank you all. And still to come, who holds the power of AI? As Congress grapples with how to rein in the AI revolution, Meet the Press reports sat down with industry insiders on how to regulate the rapidly evolving technology. Key moments from that exclusive reporting is next. You're watching Meet the Press now. Welcome back. OpenAI CEO Sam Altman will testify before Congress for the first time tomorrow as lawmakers try to figure out just how to regulate the rapidly developing artificial intelligence industry. Ahead of his appearance before a Senate Judiciary Subcommittee, Altman, whose company is behind the popular AI chatbot ChatGPT, will also speak to a bipartisan group of House members tonight. In their push for regulation, Washington hopes to get ahead of the AI arms race, something it's failed to do with other emerging technologies like social media. But their efforts are likely to encounter significant pushback from the industry. On the latest episode of Meet the Press Reports, exploring the potential and the pitfalls of AI, NBC technology correspondent Jacob Ward spoke to former Google CEO Eric Schmidt about who is best equipped to rein in AI.
I have to say, I don't hear a lot of guardrails around the industry in that. It really just, as I'm understanding it from you, comes down to what the industry decides for itself.
When this technology becomes more broadly available, which it will, and very quickly, the problems are going to get much worse. I would much rather have the current companies define reasonable boundaries.
It shouldn't be a regulatory framework. It maybe shouldn't even be a sort of a democratic vote. It should be the expertise within the industry helping sort that out.
The industry will first do that. Because there's no way a non-industry person can understand what is possible. It's just too new, too hard. There's not the expertise. There's no one in the government who can get it right. But the industry can roughly get it right, and then the government can put a regulatory structure around it.
And joining me now is NBC's Jake Ward with more of his reporting. Jake, that's a pretty blunt take from Eric Schmidt. I mean, does his attitude just show how uphill of a battle Congress faces right now? I'm up there all the time. These are not the most tech-savvy individuals, by and large.
Well, I think that's right, Garrett. I mean, we do have, of course, the, you know, the historic example of Orrin Hatch, speaking to Mark Zuckerberg when he appeared on the Hill, mm-hmm. and asked him, you know, Mr. Zuckerberg, how do you make money? And Zuckerberg said, well, Senator, we sell ads, and everyone in the room laughs, you know, and those were bad days. I will argue that, you know, in this report and in the reporting we've done over the years, Congress and legislators are becoming much more sophisticated about this stuff, not to mention regulators. I mean, you have Lina Khan, the FTC commissioner, you know, coming out in an op-ed in the New York Times really saying we have the tools already to regulate AI and pointing at the fact that it's no coincidence that the same companies we are seeing rise to the very top of the power structure of AI are the ones that collected data on us all this time in this entirely unregulated environment through search and social media. That is Google, that's Microsoft, that's Meta. And so it seems here that we, I think, are better armed than we were in the regulatory arena, but certainly it is going to be an uphill battle.
I think you're totally right. And I can tell Congress has been trying desperately to get their arms around this issue, just as I talk to lawmakers up here. But I'm curious. I mean, you've been covering this story for years. I mean, before this was an industry, even, it was something you were watching. I'm curious, as you reported out this latest episode, what was your biggest takeaway? What did you learn about the future of AI that informed your reporting?
Well, for me, there are really two big takeaways. It's why I wrote a big book about AI called The Loop. And it's, you know, I think the thing I'm going to be looking at in the future, which is there's this illusion that AI is this great leveling force and that it's available to absolutely everybody. But it turns out it's really dependent on the power of, you know, the nation state like power of these big companies to make it. And everybody's just borrowing that kind of AI from them. And the second one is the belief system of the people making the stuff, the people at the top of the companies that are at the top. People like Sam Altman, who we're going to see on the Hill tomorrow. These are folks who believe very broadly, at least they say, that they're really going to be handing society to a more advanced version of AI in the future. And that doesn't account for the, you know, huge inequalities we have in society, the huge racism we have seen built into various systems of judgment in the past, and the ways in all of that may get gathered up by AI and carried forward. No one really has an answer for that. I'm hoping that senators speaking to Sam Altman tomorrow have some sort of line of questioning on that topic.
It's fascinating stuff, Jake. Thank you. And you can catch more of Jake's reporting and stream the entire episode of Meet the Press Reports, The Power of AI. It's on demand via Peacock or YouTube right now. Don't miss it. That does it for this hour. I'm back tomorrow with more Meet the Press Now. NBC News Now coverage continues with Hallie Jackson right now.